Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We open today with cell phones. We move on to Syria. We take a brief pass at real estate and then end with scarcity. So much to do, so little time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 3rd of September. Glad to have you with us. And I don't know what it is about the cell phone business this week, but man, it's humming. A day after Verizon and Vodafone did their $130 billion thing, Microsoft decided it had to get in on the fun. The company announced today it's going to snap up Nokia's phone business and patents for the low, low price of $7.2 billion. Microsoft has been trying, without tremendous success, it must be said, to become relevant in a mobile market dominated by Apple and Samsung, which is, as Marketplace's Noel King explains, kind of the problem.
What Microsoft wants is to transform itself from a company that makes software to a company that makes and successfully sells some of the hardware, too. But can Microsoft really compete with Apple and Samsung, or is it shooting to come in third?
Absolutely, they're shooting for third best.
Richard Windsor is the founder of RadioFreeMobile.com. He says third place isn't necessarily bad.
But the critical point is that third best is plenty good enough. The mobile smartphone market is huge, and there are still plenty of rewards to be won.
Plenty of rewards, for example, in the developing world. And that's where Nokia could be a big help. Carolina Milanese is an analyst at Gartner.
They have been the strongest brand in many countries, from China to India to Southeast Asia. They can reach the consumer. They understand the consumers. They understand what it takes to be successful in a market.
Still, Microsoft and Nokia have been partnered up for 3 years without much success. How will this be better? Rob Sanfilippo of the research firm Directions on Microsoft says that's exactly the point. A partnership like the one Microsoft and Nokia had is a democracy. Both sides get to weigh in. Now?
Now it's all under one roof. There will be probably one main manager that will have the power and the control to make final decisions in the best interest of Microsoft.
It seems Microsoft is banking on that one main manager bringing two struggling companies into a healthier third place. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The main event in Washington, D.C. today was a hearing by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Syria, of course, and what the United States ought to do there. Iran and North Korea have been accused of lending Syria a helping hand with its chemical weapons program that the U.S. says the Syrian government has used. But back in the early days, the 70s and the 80s, Damascus is believed to have gotten help from Western businesses, in particular from European chemical companies. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Intelligence sources say that chemical companies in France, Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands got Syria started with chemical weapons. They supplied the country with the equipment and raw materials required. But this may not be as malevolent as it sounds. Many of those materials have innocent as well as sinister uses, says John Pike of the U.S. Defense Information Group, Global Security.
The ingredients that go into chemical weapons are the sort of ingredients that are routinely traded internationally. Nerve gas, for instance, it's basically bug spray that you use on people rather than bugs.
Outlawing these chemicals, called precursors, is out of the question, says British chemical warfare expert Richard Guthrie. Take thiodiglycol, a compound which provides the fastest route to making mustard gas. You could hardly ban it. It's a key ingredient for the dye industry.
Nobody could have normal blue jeans, because the dye stuff in your denim jeans comes from thiodiglycol.
The Chemical Weapons Convention came into force 15 years ago, and it's made the international trade in chemicals much more tightly regulated. Only 7 countries, including North Korea, Egypt and Syria, haven't signed up to it. The signatories must now exercise extreme care in selling many compounds. There's a strict inspection process. John Pike claims that replenishing a chemical arsenal is far from easy now.
I think it would be very difficult for Syria to acquire some of these precursors today compared to the relative ease they would have had before the Chemical Weapons Convention regime.
And these weapons are organic. They decay and lose their potency, sometimes quite fast, says Carl Dewey of Jane's Defence magazine.
The shelf life of precursors made to a good standard is about 5 years. When it's mixed to combined sarin, estimates go from a few weeks up to 2-3 years.
Syria's gruesome arsenal will, over time, turn into hazardous waste, but it will remain lethal for many years. Weapons experts say one of the world's first priorities, if the Assad regime falls, will be to fund the destruction of its chemical stockpile. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
You can chalk this one up in the Wall Street Does Too Pay Attention to Washington column. Traders were zipping right along in positive territory today, well into positive territory. And then Speaker of the House John Boehner said he supports a strike on Syria. It will be the happy music, but not by much, when we do the numbers. The big box office news this weekend wasn't all about number one or even number two. We're going to get down to number five, a Spanish language movie called Instructions Not Included. It was neck and neck with, for one, the latest Disney offering, Planes, that was being shown in 10 times as many theaters. And along the way, it became the biggest Spanish language movie opening in this country ever. Gustavo Arellano is the editor of the OC Weekly and the man behind the column Ask a Mexican. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola.
What's up with this movie? Where did it come from? Who is this guy? Eugenio Derbez? What?
Yeah, Eugenio Derbez is probably Mexico's best comedian right now. Longtime television personality. Audiences here in the United States might know him from the otherwise forgettable Adam Sandler vehicle, Jack and Jill. But this is a real talent. And so it's great to see Instructions Not Included be a success, as small as it may be, but nevertheless get the attention of both audiences and also critics.
This isn't really a box office story, is it? It's more a market segment story in Hollywood, inadvertently kind of getting it right with the Latino audience?
It's like every 20, okay, let's say every 15 years, Hollywood gets it right. So the last time you really had something like this, I would say, was Real Women Have Curves, which was this great film that came out about 2001, 2002. My memory fails me right now. Then before that, you had, of course, Mi Familia, the Edward James Olmos vehicles. Yep. So Hollywood is always trying to go into the Latino market, always trying to make hundreds of millions of dollars. And it doesn't really work like that. The way to start it is really to get these small independent films that have their own distinctive voice that isn't some formula, that you just plug in some Cuban or Puerto Rican actor playing a Mexican abuelita from the revolution. No, you have to give people their space to be able to do what they want to do. And the audiences always respond accordingly.
Talk to me for a second about the distributor of this movie, Pantaleon Films, joint venture of Lionsgate here in the States and Televisa down in Mexico.
So, full disclosure, Lionsgate and myself were trying to get my own Ask a Mexican television show. Yeah. But Lionsgate is very smart in knowing that they want to get the Latino audience one way or another. On television, they've been working with George Lopez to get him a new show on TBS. They're, of course, the house of Tyler Perry. Yeah. They're looking for people who they could build a whole galaxy around.
Do you think Hollywood takes the hint from this movie and starts to really think about the Hispanic-Latino market?
Oh, I wish, Kai. I really wish they would get the right response from this or they'd get the right lesson. I'm sure there's going to be a flood of such comedies in the next couple of years, and they're probably going to be really bad. But I think the biggest problem with Hollywood in both television and in film is that there's still not enough Latino writers, producers, showrunners, directors, and also financiers, frankly, because you could get all this money behind something, but if you don't have the right sentido, the right sentiment and brains behind it, it's just not going to work.
Gustavo Arellano down at the OC Weekly. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Here's something new out of the TARP. You remember the troubled asset relief program from back in the day? Part of it was something called the Hardest Hit Fund. It set aside $7.5 billion to prevent foreclosures after the housing crisis, things like mortgage assistance and principal reduction. Now, though, some states are using money meant to keep people in their homes to tear down some homes instead. Kate Davidson reports.
The first five houses came down last week in the Mary Grove neighborhood of Detroit.
It's a prayer being answered. Yes. Prayer being answered.
Velma Lewis moved here almost 30 years ago. Back then, the streets weren't dotted with abandoned homes. No one kicked in her door if she left town, like they do now.
When I moved here, it was a beautiful neighborhood. I never thought that I would retire to this here. So I am elated.
Michigan and Ohio have changed their contracts with the Treasury Department so they can use foreclosure prevention funds for home demolition. Michigan has diverted $100 million into demolition. That's a fifth of its hardest hit money and enough to tear down 7,000 vacant homes.
Here we were assisting homeowners to stay in their homes.
Mary Townley is with the Michigan State Housing Development Authority.
But then many of these communities had so many blighted properties that homeowners would throw their arms up and say, I'm never going to get value out of this house. Why am I doing this?
Officials here say blight leads to abandonment. It invites crime and drives down property values in neighborhoods where the 13,000 homeowners they've already helped are trying to hold on. They say demolishing derelict homes is foreclosure prevention. But housing activist Bruce Marks of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America says that wasn't the intent of the program.
It is a matter of priorities. And the first priority is to save the many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of homeowners who want to keep their homes, who want to stay in their homes, who do not want to be foreclosed on and to be forced out.
Over at the Treasury Department, a.k.a. the gateway to TARP funds, the chief of the Homeownership Preservation Office has a different take.
Because you have to think of this holistically.
Mark McArdle says most of the hardest hit fund will still go to keeping people in their homes. Only $160 million is slated for demolition so far, maybe more if Indiana follows suit.
If you do one without the other, you might be making a short-term investment. You want to make sure that you make a long-term investment in these communities and these homeowners. So not only is that one family able to stay in their home, but they long-term can stay in their neighborhood.
McArdle says about $2.5 billion have been claimed from the fund so far. The states have through 2017 to get the other $5 billion to struggling homeowners before it disappears. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Everyone has had the experience of 2 weeks left to do something. You dawdle. 1 day left to do something. Wow, you are focused.
The psychology of scarcity. But first, let's do the numbers. Big deals ruled the day. The Dow Industrials picked up a 10%, 23 points, 14,833 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 0.6 percent, 22 points, 36.12. The S&P 500 brought home 0.4 percent, 6 points, 16.39 there. First Verizon and Vodafone with Wall Street set to rake it in on that huge transaction. Financial stocks took a leap. J.P. Morgan Chase, the biggest benefactor, picked up 1.2%. Goldman Sachs added 1.75% today. Microsoft and Nokia, kind of a mixed reaction. Nokia, which will be acquired in the multi-billion dollar deal, soared 34%. Microsoft, the acquirer, took a 4.5% hit. I don't even know if that's the word acquirer. I guess maybe it is. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/the big book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. Automakers are slated to report August sales. And the Jewish holiday Rosh Hashanah begins at sundown. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. More than 2 years after the tsunami and nuclear meltdown at Fukushima, the news just keeps on getting worse. Government officials have admitted radiation leaks are much more severe than first reported, and the costs to contain those leaks keeps on rising. Officials announced today they're going to spend almost $500 million to deal with poisoned water alone. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that story from the Sustainability Desk.
Nobody said fixing Fukushima would be cheap or easy. Most of that $500 million will go to building a nearly mile-long underground ice wall.
Engineering-wise, it's not new science.
Ed Yarmak helped build a big wall of ice at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in the 90s. You drill pipes into the ground, fill them with some sort of coolant, and voila, the ground freezes. They build ice walls on subway and mining projects all the time. The idea here is to block contaminated water from leaking into the sea. But drilling pipes at a radioactive site, Yarmak says that ups the risk factor to a whole new level.
Keeping your people safe and not spreading the contamination around. That's the hardest part in this situation.
Talk about hazard pay, but that $500 million ice wall is just a start. Officials figure cleanup, including getting the nuclear fuel rods out of the plant, will cost about $112 billion. And, warns Peter Bradford, it'll take years. He was a nuclear regulator during the Three Mile Island disaster in the late 70s.
It was 5 years before we even got cameras close enough to the core to be sure how much damage there really was.
And Bradford says, from experience, that $112 billion cleanup estimate for Fukushima, they're just guessing at this point. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There's a big technology shindig starting in Berlin tomorrow. Rumors are the Korean firm Samsung is going to kick off the next round of Can You Top This in wearable technology with a new smartwatch. Apple, we've been led to believe, has one in the works as well. And just a couple of days ago, Google bought a startup that makes Android-powered smartwatches. All because, what, holding your smart stuff in your hand just doesn't cut it anymore? Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Smartwatches aren't new. Sony makes one, and this year, a Kickstarter campaign produced the Pebble. These watches are tethered to your smartphone. If you get an email or a tweet on your phone, you get a notice to check it on your watch. But while the watches are a cult hit with techies, they haven't caught on with the rest of us. Sarah Rotman-Epps is an analyst at Forrester.
If Samsung doesn't raise the bar from what we've seen from other watches, it's going to be a yawner.
Rumors are Samsung's smartwatch will have a 2.5-inch display and run Android. It's also supposed to have a camera, respond to voice commands, and run fitness apps. Sort of like the stuff your smartphone already does. So what's the point?
Samsung has said that they see smartphone growth slowing, and so they're looking for new products.
Tech companies can still sell a lot of smartphones in emerging markets, but in the West, the market is maturing. And some people are getting gadget fatigue. Betsy McCall is a 37-year-old artist in San Francisco.
I actually really like techie things, but I can pretty confidently say no, I would not buy it. Even recently, I've been experimenting with being less available.
And McCall says a gadget that simply promises to connect her is another gadget she doesn't need.
What we're talking about here is an evolution, not necessarily a revolution.
Scott Steinberg is an analyst with Tech Savvy. He believes wearable technologies have a future, but it's going to take something more than a connected wristwatch to get it one. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
This has been a big couple of days for cell phones, as we told you up top, but maybe we were getting ahead of ourselves. What do you suppose life would be like if you'd never gotten hooked on that oh-so-handy electronic tether? Gary Cernovitz is the managing director of the investment firm Lime Rock Partners, and if you can believe it, he doesn't have a cell phone. We'll let him tell you why.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the first official call by a handheld cell phone made by Motorola in front of reporters on the streets of New York. A few weeks after that milestone, I'll be buying my first cell phone. I'm buying one because my wife accepted a fellowship in California, and I'll need to work remotely from there when I visit her. For the last two decades, I've spent 83% of my waking hours enjoying the freedom of not owning a cell phone, 5% feeling smug about it, and 2% in situations in which a phone would have been awfully convenient, and 10% fielding incredulous questions. The first is always, how do you do your job? I'm not the junior blacksmith at the Renaissance Fair. I'm a managing director at a private equity firm. I explain that my colleagues are very tolerant. The firm provides me with all the latest communication tools, computer, telephone, post-its, right at my desk. Indeed, people lived this way back at the dawn of civilization, circa 1992. I correspond primarily during working hours and occasionally from a landline at home. I try not to change plans at the last moment, and my friends are a considerate bunch. But there is a reason, formerly private, I don't own a cell phone. I don't own a cell phone because I don't want to disappoint Henry David Thoreau. I stumbled upon Thoreau about 15 years ago. His words formed me at an age when I was ready to be formed. But I cannot help but dwell on Thoreau's most famous words as both a hope and a warning. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what I had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. But as I said, in a few weeks, I will buy a phone. I am scared. I'm afraid of losing a small part of my identity. Goodbye to no phone, Gary, cousin of dial-up Dave, wherever you are. I'm afraid of becoming rude, of placing my phone face up on a restaurant table, of playing words with friends at a funeral because the deceased did, after all, like words and have friends.
Gary Cernovitz is the managing director at the investment firm Lime Rock Partners. He first wrote about life without a cell phone for the Wall Street Journal. It being the Tuesday after Labor Day, and thus the first day of a short work week, maybe you're already feeling like you won't have enough time to get done what needs doing. Or maybe you blew your budget on a long holiday weekend getaway and have to make what's left stretch until payday. Both of the above mean you'll have to manage limited resources, or better put, deal with scarcity. Harvard University economist Sendel Bonathan and his co-author Eldar Shafir have a new book out on that topic. It is called Scarcity. Sendel, it's nice to talk to you.
Nice speaking with you.
So listen, let's cut right to the chase. Isn't there already a whole science about scarcity? Isn't it called economics? Yes?
Yes, that is what many people think.
Right.
What's interesting is that in our perspective, there are two different forms of scarcity. There's physical scarcity that we all only have a finite amount of time and money, mm-hmm. and that's what economics emphasizes. And then there's the feeling of scarcity. So all your listeners, I'm sure, have had days that have felt very short on time and mm-hmm. days that have felt very full on time. Of course, the reality is you had the same amount of time, but the psychology, that feeling that we have too little, is what really our book is about.
You guys talk about, in fact, the common logic of scarcity.
That was perhaps the biggest aha, that you can look at somebody like me who has very little time and look at somebody across the world, someone in India who has very little money. Both of us are touching on the exact same psychology. There's actually something primitive that happens to the human brain when experiencing very little. That's what really got this whole thing started.
All right, let's break that down a little bit. Let's take you and this guy in India and tear that apart. So you are a busy economist at Harvard. You're working on a book. You're probably doing some papers. You got graduate students, this and that. You have a scarcity of time. Does that not then sort of force you to be more efficient, more productive, deadlines, concentrating the mind?
Everyone has had the experience of 2 weeks left to do something. You dawdle. Mm-hmm. 1 day left to do something. Wow, you are focused. And that sort of focusing effect of scarcity, which I experience in time, the poor also actually experience with money. They become incredibly focused on every little dollar, every little penny.
Here's another thought on that, though. You ostensibly control your time and the supply thereof. The guy in India, his money supply is out of his hands.
Yeah. And that has one big consequence, which is you end up thinking about time, you end up thinking about money, even when you don't want to. We call this the bandwidth tax. The person on deadline who decides to go to their daughter's softball game that evening, well, they're at the game, but they're not really mentally at the game. They're physically present, because part of their mind keeps going back to that deadline. Here, it's not a focusing benefit, but a huge tax. And I'm saying all this because that type of tax, that type of load that scarcity creates on our mind, the busy can deal with so differently than the poor can deal with. The busy can take a vacation. The poor, unfortunately, can't say, I've had it with being poor. You know what? I'm taking a week of being rich. It just doesn't work that way.
There's another thing that comes into play here as well, and that's this trade-off thinking that you guys talk about, you know, this idea that a rich person spending 10 bucks and a poor person spending 10 bucks, or a rich person spending 10 minutes and a poor person spending 10 minutes, and what that time or money could have been used for otherwise.
I always tell people the story of picture going to a restaurant and the waiter comes and says, hey, we have this great cocktail on the menu. Would you like it? Now, you can ask an audience, what are the things that come to mind? And people will list lots of things. Hey, is my friend drinking? Does this cocktail sound good? Should I buy it? What's amazing is that the poor, in addition to all those things, say one thing comes to mind, which is, where will those $10 come from? What do I have to give up in order to get those $10?
I can't let you go without noting and giving you a little poke along the way that for all the research you guys did on scarcity, you blew your deadlines on this book. Scarcity was not your friend.
Scarcity was not our friend. And it really goes back to something fundamental. A deadline that's not binding, it doesn't really create enough scarcity.
That's right. Senabal Anathan is a professor of economics at Harvard University. He is the co-author with Eldar Shafir of a new book about scarcity called Scarcity. Sendel, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which I have never been so happy to see promoted tweets. That is, tweets that companies, or in this case, a person, buys special placement for to get them extra attention. Ads, basically. Anyway, a British Airways passenger who tweets under the handle at HVSVN got just plain sick and tired of the airline not returning his emails about his lost luggage. He took to Twitter to vent, as many of us do, but not just to his 500 followers. He bought a series of promoted tweets to target all of British Airways' 302,000 followers to spread his message of discontent, which I just love. Don't know how much he paid, but it was pretty smart, I thought. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 0.1%, about 23 points. The NASDAQ up 0.6%, 22 points. The S&P 500 brought home 0.4%, 6 points. Thanks to Lana Anwar, Meg Kramer, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The interim producer of Marketplace Morning Report is Sean Bowditch. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.